Pod. 22 Pod. Hey, how you doing? You all right?
No, I'm, yeah. Not bad, mate. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Good to finally speak to you.
And you, yeah. Is that an Arcade Fire album in the background?
It is, yeah.
Nicely.
I was listening to it the other night, and I have whatever record I've been listening to last kind of propped up against the record player.
So. Yeah, I do that as well, yeah. Nice one. Whereabouts are you?
In Kingston-upon-Thames, okay. So just outside of London, yeah. I was living in Wimbledon until last year, and then girlfriend and I got a place here together. So, yeah, it's nice. Not bad. Kind of.
Ah, nice one.
Kind of. In London, but just a little bit out, and there's not a bad little music scene here either. Banquet Records, I don't know if you heard of them, they put on a lot of decent gigs, like warm-up shows and album release shows and stuff by decent bands, so it's pretty good.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, yeah. I bought tickets to watch Wharf Alice there, I think.
Yes,
I couldn't go in the end, but yeah, a lot of good bands play there.
Oh, yeah, no, I went to that one, yeah. Wharf Alice, their Block Party, Franz Ferdinand, saw Suede there just before Christmas and stuff, yeah. It's decent.
Nice one. Is it similar to... Is this place in the book, is it fictional?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
What's it called again?
Malford, yeah.
Malford, yeah. That's it, yeah.
So that's more based on Colchester, where I grew up, yeah. Which is similar, about an hour outside of London, but still feels kind of a lifetime away from London, even though it's only like an hour on the train or whatever. It's a bit of a military town and not a whole lot going on there. But yeah, so kind of based the place in the book on that more than where I am now, yeah.
Okay. I don't know whether to start with your own music stuff or the book. I guess it makes sense to start with the music, really. So you were in a band yourself.
Yeah.
You know, writing bang in the middle of this period, starting in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
You started with your brother? Is that right?
Yeah, so it was around 2002, just when me and some mates left college. And as soon as we left college, we just kind of booked a studio and started getting together, and could barely really play our instruments. But I remember at one of the early rehearsals, the guy who ran the studio just sort of coming in and being like, guys, turn it down. You know, that's not music. You need to make sure you're playing in tune with each other. We were just like making a racket, but we were loving it. But and then slowly some songs started to sort of develop out of it. But I was singing, and I still don't, but even back then when I was 17, didn't have the strongest of voices. So my brother was off at uni, and had got, you know, I was sending him a few tapes of stuff we were working on, and he basically started, he was at Derby at uni, and he kept sort of coming back for rehearsals every couple of fortnight or so. And, you know, he was kind of the bit we needed, that vocal ahead of, you know, the kind of noise we were making, above the noise we were making. And then he ended up dropping out of uni and deferring to Essex, and then that's when it really sort of got going with him. He's about 4 years older than me, so he had quite a good stage presence and voice, and yeah, we started playing local shows. We got a second guitarist in, who was a friend of mine from college, and we sort of got our sound together. It was kind of influence wise sort of Radiohead, Idlewild, Mannix, Blur, Super Free Animals, big fans of them, Cooper Temple, Claws, Death Cab, that kind of thing. So it's kind of sort of not like sort of clanky indie, more sort of meaty, rocky kind of thing. And we did all right. Yeah, we never made it as such, but we had a good journey up until about 2008. So pretty much spanning the whole period of your podcast, really. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It sounds like you did well. Like you got significant radio play on XFM, and you won Diesel U Music Award.
Yeah, so we were, you know, first off, the first demo we recorded was really crap. We used this like a cowboy producer in a garage in Colchester, and we were like, you know, this isn't what's coming across live. And then we recorded a really decent demo just somewhere else in Essex with a producer called Grant Matthews. I don't know if he's still about, but he really like sort of nailed our sound. And this was back when you'd be recording like on, you know, analog tape and stuff. And And that demo caused a bit of a stir. It got us really good gigs, like support gigs for bands that were coming into Colchester, like Cara Cult and people like that. We'd be given like the sort of support slots for decent touring bands. And then we started playing in London, Dublin Castle, Bullengate, that kind of thing. And then, yeah, there was this thing called the Diesel U Music Awards. And it's definitely not still going. I think it only ran for a few years, but there was an advert for it in the back of the NME. And, this was the point where I was sending off demos left, right and centre, sent it out to them. And then I didn't think much of it. And a few weeks later, we got told that we'd won the best rock category. So it was for unsigned bands across country, but we won best unsigned rock band, which was judged by the NME. So obviously that was pretty good. And we got invited to this thing in Fabric, which was then shown live on Channel 4. Not live on Channel 4. It was about 2 weeks later. Yeah, it was shown on Channel 4. But we were very aware that it was being filmed and that there was really good, like decent lineup. Kasabian played.
Really?
Yeah, Goldie Looking Chain, some other bands from like the other areas, hip hop and electronic and stuff. And it was at Fabric. And yeah, it was a great, great night. It was a night that will live with me forever, really. And then off the back of that, Fierce Panda Records came to one of our gigs in London, and they really liked it, and said to us basically that, you know, if we were someone like Green Day or something, they would put out 7-inch single or a single, but because they knew there was a little bit more to our sound, like we had some long instrumental sections and we had sort of songs that were slightly different to each other, they said, do you want to do an EP? And we were like, yeah, hell yeah. So we recorded that, and that came out in 2005, the year after. And Did all right. Got good reviews in, it got 4 out of 5 in Kerrang, 8 out of 10 in The Enemy and Drown and Sound and stuff. But don't think it sold a huge amount, like maybe a couple of thousand or so. But it was interesting, actually. I was listening to one with Hugo from the Maccabees a couple of weeks ago, and our career trajectories were pretty similar to theirs up until the same point. We were, causing a bit of a stir locally, and then we did some stuff on Fierce Panda. We just never had the bigger label come in and sign us, really. We had them, Universal, Sony, everyone come to these gigs in London, and just for whatever reason, never made the jump upwards. I don't know. I think when we played back home, we were like, they were really good shows and people were really into it. And then you go to London and it's just sort of like everyone's, standing there with their arms folded and you get nervous, and your performance is kind of reflected in that. And I didn't realize as well, we're not a boy band, but the amount of sort of the business side to it, where these labels would be like, oh yeah, no, you need to get your hair cut like this, you need to fit yourself into jeans that are cutting off the circulation to your balls, and
they would say that to you, kind of.
Yeah, like it was all about that point, having a kind of gang image. It was the Libertines, Kasabian, and I could kind of see that they need to know how to market you. But we were being told that we needed to like lose weight and stuff, and I was a lot skinnier then when I was 22 than I am now, and it's just like, yeah, we've been told we need to lose weight, we need to do this, need to do that. I think they really wanted us to write. They knew we had good songs, but they were more sort of an album or a live show, and we needed a hit single, which possibly a fair or a lead single at least and stuff. And so we did that quite a while. And similar to what Hugo was saying, really, that like I enjoyed it. Always, it was always an escalation. At first, it was like, can we write a song that sounds like an actual song? Then it's like, can we write a set of songs? Can we do some gigs? Can we do a demo? And then do a video. And then you're always enjoying it while you're on that upper level, escalation. But I think we kind of hit a bit of a glass ceiling where we then started, playing shows to the same places, the same people, or even less people, whatever. Your buzz doesn't last very long. Like 2005 was our buzz year. And then we sort of went away and did a record, like a full album by ourselves, which was a lot better than the EP. But by that point, we just couldn't really get, Fierce Panda were kind of interested, but kind of moved on. We just couldn't get anyone really to put it out, even though Spotify was just dying by that point and stuff. And it was on all those kind of things and people really enjoyed it. We just couldn't. I think once people have come to see you and passed you up for whatever reason, it's really difficult to get them to come again and stuff. So we kind of carried on for maybe a year after that album, sort of about 2008. And there was no big falling out or anything. We just all decided, you know, I went off to uni, studied creative writing, which is part of, you know, feeds into the book. When our guitarist went to New Zealand, a lot of his family moved out there, he decided to move out there. And so I still speak to them all. They're all still good friends, you know, but we just kind of petered out in a way. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, you mentioned Colchester, like, just always interested in what the local scenes are like in this place. But you say there was a bit of a crowd that you had in Colchester.
There wasn't. I wouldn't say there was really a scene. There was stuff going on, but there was no bands like similar really to us that we felt like, oh, we're part of this scene. There was a lot of metal. There's a lot of punk. There's two kind of main venues. One called the Twist, which was more kind of punk and metal, and then there's the Art Centre, which was like the biggest venue, where it's probably only about 400 or 500 capacity, but where all the touring bands would come. I saw Coldplay play there on their first tour with Terrace. They did, you know, like in 2000, where they weren't even headliners. Saw Coldplay there, and Idlewild and Ash and people like that. But so yeah, there wasn't really a scene that we felt part of. But we were always friends with other bands that we played with and stuff. But the band we got on best with were like a kind of metal band who were just not our kind of thing, really. There was one band called Neat People who are managed by Blur's manager. They did some shows in London, maybe a single and stuff. And I think that's the thing. Everyone always said we're going to be the next Blur, just because Blur are from Colchester, but we didn't. We didn't ever really sound like them. It was just a lazy sort of comparison, you know, oh, they could be the next Blur and whatever. And Steve Lamack, he's from Colchester, and he played us a little bit on Radio 1, and we had a video on MTV 2 and that kind of stuff. And they were real, like, you know, pinch me moments, you know, considering where it come from. But we just never really made that full leap to being able to. We're always doing day jobs and everything. And, you know, you drive to London for gigs and you get home at like 1:30 in the morning, then you'd have to be at work at like 8:39 the next day and stuff. But like when you're young, you can just do that. And it's great times, really.
Yeah, yeah. It must have been quite useful living within like an hour of London kind of thing.
Yeah, it could have been worse. it could have been like trekking. But I think sometimes those bigger cities that are further away have their own scene, you know, like Manchester or Nottingham or whatever. I think we were close enough to London that we cultures didn't really have a scene, but far enough away that record labels wouldn't come to Colchester to watch us. They make us, you know, sometimes they'd be like, have you got any London gigs on? And we'd be like, no. So we put one on specifically because such and such from Universal or a promoter would want to come see us. And sometimes they wouldn't even turn up, you know, or they'd turn up at 10 o'clock when I told them we're on at 9 o'clock, and you put them on the guest list and they come after you played, or they wouldn't even turn up and stuff. So stuff like that was a bit frustrating. The amount of times we trekked to London and had people like cancel on us last minute or not turn up and stuff. And but yeah, no, I can't complain really. We had some great times and stuff. Like our album EP was released in Japan. I still got a copy of that where all the lyrics are translated into Japanese inside it and stuff like that. With like bonus tracks that you always have to put on and stuff like that. And had a friend of mine who was on holiday in New York and sent me a photo of our album in the big Times Square Virgin Megastore or whatever it was and stuff like that. And yeah, no, like really, really great. Yeah. But I don't know. I don't really deal in regrets because it was an amazing time. But, you know, I just certain things never fell into place for us. And I think around the time Arctic Monkeys came out around 2005, around that kind of period. And I think the music kind of moved maybe slightly to that kind of sort of indie sort of narrative lyrics, which wasn't really us. I kind of tended to do more imagery and cool ideas, more like Idlewild and Primal Scream and kind of that, rather than sort of kitchen sink kind of, I mean, don't get me wrong, Alex, a great lyricist.
I know what you mean.
Great lyricist, and that first album, great lyrics. But then it did spawn a load of shy bands as well, which were not us. I can't even remember their names, but, you know, and that kind of London beat scene. I like Mystery Jets and stuff like that, but like, there were some bands on there that I just thought, I don't think this, you know, and music just kind of moves and it kind of maybe moved away from, I think, Fierce Panda basically tried to market it as their Radiohead. And I think by that point, Radiohead were not so in vogue by that point and stuff. So, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. You know, well, the other thing that happened as well, which I mean, again, I don't want to start with bad luck and stuff, but I broke my wrist playing football around the time, shortly after that These Are Your Music Award thing, and we had all the gigs booked in London and stuff, and just basically went up for a header playing football, landed on my arm and broke my wrist. So we had to cancel some gigs. We had to one of my brother's friends in came in to play guitar, and he did a really decent job, to be fair. But like he was only just learning the song, so he would stand there with no stage presence, and there wasn't no chemistry between me and my brother and stuff for those gigs and stuff. And it was just such bad timing. You know, looking back, I don't know what I was doing playing football when we had all this stuff coming up. But
but you did. I remember we had a small band. But yeah, I remember playing football loads around that time and not even thinking about being able to play an instrument for an injury. Yeah.
No, exactly. And then when I came back, like had the cast on for like 6 weeks or whatever. And then when they finally take it off, all the muscle was like wasted away because you're not going to have to use it for 6 weeks. So then I had to learn to play guitar. But it was a few weeks before I could build up the strength to play guitar. We had one gig where Tom, this lad, was filling in for me. And then Dom, our other guitarist, had been in hospital with some kind of weird abscess in his nose. Anyway, I was there, but I wasn't going to play because my cast was off, but I had no strength in it, in my wrist. And his nose just started like bleeding from this operation he had. And we left it about half an hour. And like, you're still going to be able to play, aren't you? And he's like, I think I need to go to hospital. So somebody took him to hospital, and I had to play with basically a broken wrist and the other guitarist. And we had this song where, Quiet Playground, I think I sent you the video. So it builds up to this big thing where it stops and then it kicks in. And my brother was like, one of our guitarists is in A&E, the other one's got a broken broken wrist, but here we are, absent kid, and kicked in. Kids went crazy, but it was just like such a weird gig. And then we had this other song where it was just kind of thrashed out on two chords at the end, and the guitarist went to hospital, his guitar was still set up. So my brother passed it to this lad and it's like, oh, it's A minor and F. And this like the lad starts playing along and stuff. And then at the end, he just thought that he could take the guitar home with him. He thought we'd given him the guitar. It's like, we're not in the position to be giving away, you know, £350 guitars or whatever. But he was like literally trying to sneak out the venue with it. And we had to say, no, but whatever. We never can. Well, but maybe a couple when we broke my wrist, but we never cancelled a gig. You know, the show must go on, even though we had one guitarist in hospital and my wrist was broken. Yeah,
that's mad. Yeah. So what you were, in terms of songwriting, you were writing the lyrics for the band?
I was, sometimes my brother would, because he would fill in some blanks for me, or as he was a singer, if there was any bits that he didn't like or didn't want to sing, which was kind of fair enough. But generally, the songs would come from me. Yeah, I was always into English at school, did English A-level, and that was always sort of my strength. I'm not a virtuoso guitar player, but like I can, you know, got a decent ear for melody, and then if we jam something, we'd sit down and write the lyrics and stuff for the song. So yeah,
stuff. And did you record this thing on Channel 4? Is it on video somewhere?
Yeah, my parents have probably still got it on VHS somewhere. Yeah, it was.
Put it on YouTube.
It was weird, and it got repeated like the following year. I think around the time that the next one was coming up, and then we suddenly got a massive influx of people on our MySpace and stuff saying, right, seen you on TV, and they repeated it at like 1:30 in the morning the following year or something. I think it only ran the Diesel Year Music Awards for like 2 or 3 years, but yeah, it was great. That day we went up to London, and we were allowed to go to the Diesel shop in Leicester Square, wherever it was, and just like help ourselves to all this clothing and stuff. And I'm sure some of the bands in Colchester thought we were like right sellouts or whatever. But I was like, you're telling me you turned down the chance to go and get a load of free clothes and then play, you know, a gig at Fabric that's on Channel 4? It's like, you wouldn't.
Say that because
you haven't been offered it. But it was a great day. Yeah.
And did you interact with any of the other bands on the night or anything?
I not so much the bands. I remember speaking to John Peel, which was great. He was there. He was given a Lifetime Achievement Award, and I had a chat with him. And it's so surreal when you speak to somebody like that whose voice is like so recognizable, and they're like talking to you in that voice. It's like as if someone's doing an impression. So chatted to him for a bit. Chatted to Mick Jones from the Clash. I'm not sure why he was there. I don't know if he was playing in some band or he was there. Goldie Looking Shame were there. Conor McNicholas from the Enemy. I enjoyed listening to your episode with him quite a while back because he was there, and I remember having quite a chat with him about music at the time and what was going on and stuff. I think he liked us. I don't think he loved us quite as much as there were some other people on the NME panel who chose us as the winners. And I think the other people were possibly more keen on us than him. But he was kind. He liked us. And we got a few bits in the NME. And it's crazy. We got a photographer all the way down to like Mersey Island, which is where my parents live and where I grew up. It's actually like even further than Colchester, like 10 miles out. It's
right.
Like a basically a fishing village, but it's an island and there's like one road on and off that floods twice a day, and it's so rude. And it's crazy to us that back then, you know, the NME had the budget to send somebody all the way down to Mersey Island to take photos of us and stuff. And we were on like the radar piece, double post like spread thing about new bands and stuff. And it was great.
I mean, that'd be mad, like Getting featured in the NME would have been very surreal if we never got that to that stage, but I can imagine it was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could pick it up the day before in London, I think. Mm. It came out on Wednesday, everywhere else on Tuesday. And I remember we'd been in London for a meeting with such and such, and we saw it on the stand and we flicked through it, and then we were and stuff. And yeah, it was great. But I'm pretty sure the shutdown for that day, we didn't have the budget to be sending people, photographers, out to to deepest darkest Essex to do photos and stuff. And but you know, there was a lot more money involved in everything back then. But
but
that's part of it. We didn't have really a cohesive image. And I remember like the night before we were doing that photo shoot, we're like, what are we gonna wear, what's our vibe and stuff, because we really just wore like jeans and t-shirts and stuff, and we were trying to scrap together a kind of image and stuff. And probably if I did have one regret, would have been that we were trying to get that together, even if you don't want to go full on, like, you know, libertines or Kasabian of an image, just try and get some kind of coherent look and stuff. I think Steve Lamax said something like, we look like five people standing at a bus stop together, like, or something like that.
Wow.
But, but Simon Williams at Fierce Panda, he loved us. He was our like biggest advocate, really. And I just finished reading his book, actually. He's got a book out called Pandemonium, which is...
Oh, really? I might read that.
Yeah, it's good. Really good. When you look at the amount of bands that pass through them, you know, Hash, Idlewild, Nicky, Embrace, Coldplay, Keen, Three Colors of Red, Blue Tones, Placebo. It's like they had so many good bands come through them. So we were absolutely buzzing to do an EP on them. And then we did a single, Quiet Playground Count, as a single, I think early 2005 as well.
Yeah. So when you say signed with them and you're up... But yeah, you're also talking to like majors as well.
Well, we weren't really signed with them. What they do is they basically, I mean, this is one of the things in his book that he wishes he'd probably be more watertight with contracts and less sort of done on gentlemen's agreements and stuff. I don't actually remember signing something other than them saying like, look, we'll pay for all your recording. We'll get it in the shops. We'll get it on iTunes or Amazon, what it would have been there. And we'll just split everything 50-50, which is what we did. And it worked great. But we were never tied into them. And then that's part of how they make their money really bigger. I think they've now sorted it, or they did sort it, so that when bigger labels came in and took people like Coldplay and Keane, they would get a very small percentage of every sale moving forward, which obviously it might be 0.5% or even less than that. But for someone like Coldplay, that's still going to be a big amount of money. But so we were never signed with them. And then we did the single, then we did the demos of what became our album, and we sent them to them and they kind of liked them. But it sort of, I think they'd sort of moved on to some, they had some other bands at the time, Shit Disco, Art Brutes, Maccabees were about, stuff like that. And they just decided that it soon became apparent that they weren't going to put the album out for us, and they moved on. But I spoke to Simon the other day, actually, and it was all good. But we put the album out ourselves. And
so how do you go about getting a producer and stuff for the album when you're doing it yourself, or do you just...
This was probably the best week I ever had, like, is in the band. We went to Wales, and somebody told us about this producer out there who'd worked with like The Joy Formidable and Funeral for a Friend and various pieces people. We had enough money from gigs and bits and pieces, and we just went out there for a week, and we were recording in his house and then just staying in this like kind of bunk bedroom. And in the evenings we were just playing like FIFA and going to the pub, and every day we'd get up at 10 and record till like 6-7, and at the end of the week we came out with an album. And it's just like you're kind of on holiday but you come back with an album at the end of it. It was really great. But unless you've got that distribution that Fierce Panda had, things were kind of changing around that point in terms of digital and everything. Spotify had just come out around that period, I think, and stuff. And yeah, people who heard it really liked it, and it was, the songs and the production was better than our EP we did, but it, just not enough people heard it really. And we were gigging and selling a few gigs and stuff, but you just I don't know, we'd hit a glass ceiling. And then the most fun you have in a band is when you're just, I think when you're starting out and you're not really like beating yourself up and you're not really like trying to make it, you're just enjoying playing music with friends. And by that point we were really just like, everything was like trying to make it and get attention and get this. We've been doing it for, I don't know, 6-7 years or something, and then you just like it becomes not a chore, but you're not enjoying it in the same way that you used to, really.
Yeah. How do you even go about trying to distribute it? Is it like distribution companies that you can?
Yeah, there was something, I think they're called CD Baby or something like that, where you could pay a small fee and they would distribute it on iTunes and Amazon it was on Spotify and all this, that and the other and stuff. And so it was sort of widely available. But when I look back to the Fierce Panda days, we had a press team. We never really had a manager, which another thing, we always sort of managed ourselves up until just after Fierce Panda where we got a manager. But other than that, it was all doing it ourselves. But with Fierce Panda, you had a press person, plugger, all that kind of stuff, and we'd get reviews in various bits, and you'd pick up a few fans from there, and from there we were constantly gigging and stuff. But yeah, it was widely available. Misadventure, it's called. It's on Spotify if anyone wants to listen to it. Absent Kid, Misadventure. But because I'm still proud of that record, but it just didn't get heard by enough people, really.
No, I was impressed with quite a few of the songs. I thought they were, because you do. You know, when someone tells you I had a band in the 2000s, like, and you haven't heard them before, you're like, right.
Cringe, yeah.
Oh, you're like, I don't know about that. Yeah, you're just like, you're expecting maybe something a bit possibly bland.
Yeah.
But it's not like that at all. Like,
no, we were never really
quite different to a lot of those bands. Yeah.
Yeah, we were never really like that kind of clinky clanky, skinny jeans kind of indie. We were probably a little bit before that, and our influence is a bit wider than that. And, yeah, but I think as that really came into vogue, we fell a bit out of fashion. But in lockdown, I went for a run and I was like, what should I put on? And I put Misadventure on the album and ran for like 50 minutes or whatever the duration of the album. I hadn't listened to it in full for years. And I was like, no, this still is a decent record. It should have been heard by more people. But there's no point in dwelling on these kind of things.
I'd recommend people listening to it, definitely. And then just reading on the Wikipedia that you recorded a song for Colchester United that's still played, apparently. Is it still played?
It wasn't last time I went, but it was until very recently, yeah. As it happens, I got my Colchester United mic here. We did, yeah, they approached us. This was at the very tail end of Absent Kid and said there was a song called Up the Ewes that's a kind of chant that fans sing, and they were like, oh, do you want to do a version of it? I don't know, I don't even think they paid us. I think we were just happy to do it. And I think they paid for the studio and we just recorded it, and we got some fans in to sing the backing vocals. And then Eddie the Eagle, which is the mascot, turned up in his, you know, his big suit, basically an eagle suit, and sang on it as well and stuff. And it was weird because I live in London now, and I moved to London around 2008 or so. So I don't go to as many Colchester games as I used to, but whenever I would go to home games, yeah, you'd hear it just before the teams came out and stuff. And so stuff like that was like just like great. In fact, they in 2007, Colchester moved stadiums from Layer Road, which is like a very old terrace ground, to a new stadium. And we played on the pitch for the very last game at Layer Road.
Amazing.
Before the teams came out, we played like three or four songs, and there was like loads of stuff going on that day because it was literally the last game, and it's getting knocked down a few weeks later. And so stuff like that, you know, you can't really put a price on it, just like memories that will just, I'll always have, yeah.
No, that's it. Like, I had a similar experience. Well, I didn't play, but in terms of supporting Hull
Yeah.
Our ground, we moved grounds.
Yeah.
Got knocked down in the early 2000s. So like being able to play the last game at Burfrey Park would have been amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we used to play Hull a lot around that period. And then you stole our manager from us, Phil Parkinson.
Yeah. Yeah. And you absolutely thrashed us, I think.
Yes. He came back that season and we beat you 5-1 at Lay Road. That would have been the last season at Lay Road, I think, or second from last. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, we used to play Hull a lot back then. Always used to bring a decent support with them. Yeah.
Yeah. I think my mate went to that game because it was also thing around Craig Fagan as well, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Can you listen to that song on YouTube, by the way, the football one?
It's called Up the Use, and Absent Kid, it's on there, it's on YouTube somewhere.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page where you can see extended video versions of the interviews as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. Right, yes, I guess we should move on to the book.
Yeah, go on, sorry.
No, yeah, like where... Yeah, how long have you had this, like the idea of doing a book?
Well, so when the band finished, I went to Roehampton Uni, where I, which is kind of southwest London, near Putney and Kingston, where I ended up settling, really. And I did creative writing and journalism. And for creative writing, you had modules that were like short stories, screenplays. There was a songwriting module and stuff as well. So I'd always written like some short stories and stuff for that, which had always got decent marks and stuff, and I enjoyed it. But so I work full time, working marketing, where I write content and create web pages and social media and that kind of stuff. And I'd always sort of had this idea of writing a music based novel, because I mean there's some really good books, music books, but they're not novels. They're autobiographies or biographies. I really like the sort of oral histories they do, like one on New York, Meet Me in the Bathroom, and there's a Seattle one, Everyone Loves Our Town, which is really great as well. But I've never, unless I'm looking in the wrong place, I've never really read a really great music novel. I'm not saying mine is a really great one, but I thought there was a kind of gap in the market, especially for that sort of band, you know, with the teenagers, youngsters up and coming, and sort of really sort of a realistic portrayal of the highs and lows of being on the toilet circuit and that kind of camaraderie with friends and stuff. And when the lockdown hit, 2020, I just had the time that I hadn't had before. You know, there's only so many evenings that you can sit watching Netflix before, and I wasn't playing in a band at this point for the first time in quite a long time, and I was just like, right, I'm gonna start writing in the evenings. And I wrote a few chapters, and I was enjoying it, and I sent them to a friend of mine, and he was like, yeah, I'm really enjoying this. And he was like, send me some more. And I was like, I haven't got any more. He's like, well, you can have to write some more, because I want to know what happens to the characters now. You know, so that was really encouraging. And just started writing it. And I think by the end of 2020 I had the first draft together. And I thought it was quite decent. I got a few people to read it who seemed to enjoy it, but I didn't think it was good enough to send to publishers or anything at that point. So I worked with a mentor, a lady called Anna Jean Hughes, who has written some books, but she also has worked as what I call a reader in a publishing house. So she knows what publishers are looking for, or more importantly, what turns publishers off of manuscripts and stuff. So she came back with some really, really good feedback on the first draft of what worked, what didn't work, what I should develop. It was a bit short as well. It was about 40,000 words, and or 38,000 words, and anything over 40 is a novel. It ended up being like 59,000 words. And you know, it's not a case of padding it out, it's more like you know, you should develop a subplot here and you should take that bit further and you should do this. And she was really great for that. So then I think it probably took me another 6 months, a year to finish the second draft, like not continuously, like I'd write sometimes for a week or two and then not for a while and this, that and the other. And it was always just in the background. Girlfriend probably got sick of me talking about it. And I would always, you know, put some music on from that period and just write. And then eventually kind of finished to the point where my mentor was happy with it. And she said, yeah, this is really good. You should start sending it around. And it reminded me of being in a band and sending out demos and trying to get some interest. It was the same. You basically send out the opening chapters. And then if they're interested, they want the full manuscript and a breakdown of the whole plot and stuff. And I got a lot of thanks, but no thanks. But then eventually small publisher said, like, you know, we don't think this is mainstream, but for like people who are into music, they'll really like this, so we'll put out 500 copies, and then there's also the Kindle version on Amazon and stuff as well. So yeah, it's been really great to see that project through. I once I'd finished it, I was like, by hook or by crook, I'm getting this out here now, because it's so much work to write a novel. I didn't really realize that. I was like, I can't just leave this on my computer for the rest of my life. It's got somebody, even if I print it off myself and go handing it out, so I've got to have some kind of reward at the end of this. You know, it's like if you did a demo or an album and no one heard it, it's just like you need that thing with the full circle of it getting out there. And I mean, it's a lot less instant with music. You know, it's like 3 minutes. You can ping someone a track and they can tell you what they think of it. With books, you don't get that instant gratification. But like a few weeks after it came out in the end of November, you know, people then started telling me that they finished it and they enjoyed it, or sending me bits that made them smile and stuff. And it's a lot more. But then some people have bought it and it's still stuck on their, you know, to read list. I'm just like, My instinct is like, oh, they hated it. They haven't got around to reading it yet. It's a big thing to get around to reading books, isn't it? Like, I've still got books on my shelf that I bought years ago that I haven't read. But for me, I'm like, read it, goddammit.
Yeah, and it took me a couple of months, just dipping in and out of it kind of thing. Yeah. But am I right in thinking you're a similar? Am I right in thinking you're a similar age to me?
Probably 38. I am.
Yeah, a bit older than me then. But just wondered why you chose to set it in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So it's set in 1997. So I would have been like 13 at that age. And the characters in the book are like 17, 18. So obviously a bit older. But for me, I don't know, it's still the halcyon kind of period of music and TV, the 90s, obviously a Britpop and everything that was going on. And I just thought I would set it around then. And also setting it in the 90s, you can strip away all the modern technology and stuff, so there's a lot more romance, I think, to somebody a mixtape or sending a demo off or congregating in record shops, and there is, you know, MSN or Spotify, or making someone a Spotify playlist, or pinging them a message on MSN and stuff like that. And like mobile phones as well, writers now have to make real reasons why someone can't contact somebody. Like, their mobile phone has to fall in a lake or has no reception and all that kind of stuff. It's a real problem for writers. And I just thought, well, I'll set it in 97, where nobody, certainly that age, didn't really have a mobile phone. The internet was sort of around, and there is a couple of emails and stuff in the book when at university, but like, people generally didn't really have it. It certainly didn't play much of a part in the music industry back then. It was all demo tapes and all that kind of stuff. And I liked not imagining that period, because I was around, I was 13, but I wasn't really going out and that kind of stuff. But that's why I just thought, strip away the technology. And I want it to be, even though the band in the book are not a Britpop band, that kind of era with you know, Suede, Oasis, Blur and Pavement and all those bands, Smashing Pumpkins and all that kind of stuff. I really liked getting into that era and listening to music from that era and writing it in that period. Yeah.
And like the main character, Will, how much of yourself did you put in him, do you think?
I mean it's easy to make parallels. I think all the things that I learned on my creative writing thing was like to write about what you know and to write from experience. I didn't want it to be like autofiction where, you know, it is sort of, you use your own name and it's like, oh, I just think that's a bit wanky. I think quite often if you read a book, if it's a book that's a court case drama, you'll find that the writer used to be a barrister, or if it's a book that's set in rural Ireland or something, you'll find that they grew up in rural Ireland. You like to write with enough authenticity and to be able to see and feel and sort of, you know, portray places, you need to have been there and seen it. So, you know, I couldn't write a military base thing, you know, I just wouldn't know where to start, or something set on a submarine or something. But the, you know, the unsigned band world of toilet venues and sound checks, and I know more than I need to. So it's you know, so I wrote it from the point of view of Will, who's the main songwriter and guitarist in the band. So I guess there's a parallel to me there. But also some of the book is from Amy's point of view. So for those who haven't read it, it's sort of this lad, Will, his dad has just passed away a couple of years prior, and he starts a band with his mates. And they start gigging and there's a bit of buzz around them. But the singer, Jake, is more popular when it comes to girls, until a couple of gigs in, he meets a girl called Amy, who, so it's basically a coming of age girl meets boy story, but with music as the backdrop to it throughout the book.
Yeah, I wondered if there was that dynamic between Will and Jake. I wondered if that was anything like you and your brother or anything like that.
No, it's actually more like the dynamic between me and our drummer. He was the popular one with okay. the girls and stuff. But yeah, and I've got a weird review actually on Amazon. Actually, all the reviews and stuff being on Amazon have been great, but there's one that was 3 stars, and they said that they would think I should have done the love story between Will and Jake instead of Will and Amy. And I was like, that would have changed the book quite fundamentally. But I guess there is that kind of Pete and Carl bromance type thing in the Libertines and stuff. But yeah, no, that was never the intention. It was always meant to be a sort of, I read, Sweet Sorrow by David Nichols, which is kind of I seem to always get compared to him in the few reviews and stuff, and the publishers tried to kind of market me along those lines, and he wrote Sweet Sorrow, and it's a boy girl thing with the amateur dramatics theatre as the background to it. And my mentor was kind of like, yeah, that's your blueprint, like it's boy meets girl thing but with music as the thread, you know, throughout it instead of amateur dramatics. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it? Yeah, like you say, it's kind of similar to being in a band, trying to like get the book out there, I guess. Do you get people giving you advice? How intrusive can the advice be? Like you say, with the major record labels, with your own band, telling you to lose weight and stuff. Like, is it more helpful, the stuff you're getting in terms of the book, really?
Yeah, sometimes it was. Yeah, no, I never had anyone who's like really, really mean about it. You'd get a lot who'd ignore you. You'd get some people who'd give you a token bit of feedback about this, that, and the other. But I think, to be honest, they're so busy. And I think I wasn't the only person who, you know, picked up a pen and knocked down. They were probably inundated by stuff and, you know, half finished stuff and this, that, and the other. But I got it to a decent shape. And sometimes I take on board with, you know, their feedback. And it's the same with the mentor. Some, you know, most of what she said, sometimes I'd have my courage, my convictions to go, no, I don't want to go down that route. She wanted it to be, I think, wanted it to be a bit more Irvine Welsh kind of train spotting John Niven. And while there is some sort of a drug storyline throughout, I didn't want it to be that really sort of grimy kind of drug kind of world and where everything's dirty and sort of. I still wanted it to be quite nice sort of more of what my upbringing was and stuff. But yeah, I always took on board feedback from people. I think you'd have to be quite blinkered to be someone, especially if several people are telling you the same thing, then it's probably true. You need to address it and stuff. But I had a good friend of mine who reads a lot as well, was really great and went through it like line by line. And it really helped, as well as my mentor and stuff. They helped a lot more than publishers. But the publishers didn't really have many rewrites for me. The only thing that I'd done is I'd quoted lots of song lyrics, like if something came on the radio, people would sing along to it, or karaoke and this, that, and the other. And they're like, oh, you, unless you get permission from the publishers, which can take a long time and cost a lot, you need to take out this lyric and this, that, and the other, which was really annoying, because I'd had to lose sections that I thought were good, or have to rewrite them when they weren't as effective.
And you mean lyrics from other bands, you mean?
Yeah, so there's lyrics from Sharpshooter, which is the band which obviously I wrote. But then I would quote, I don't know, an Oasis lyric or Blur lyric or something like that, and just you can't, for copyright reasons, you have to get permission. So you can use titles, but you can't use lyrics, and so I had to, that was annoying. And I really fought for, there's a bit where one of them says, what the hell is a Zigga Zigar anyway, when Spice Girls on the radio. And she wanted me to take that out because they said the Zigga Zigar is a word that's, you know, very synonymous with Spice Girls and copyright, and I really fought for that. I was like, it's one word, just like, if we get sued, I'll pay for it. Hopefully we haven't yet.
Yeah. I'm sure the Spice Girls don't listen to this podcast.
No, and I went on Etsy, and loads of people have made posters and mugs and stuff with it on, and I was like, they'll surely clamp down on that first and one line it. But
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the band, you mentioned Sharpshooter. Did you like... Did you want them to be a good band? Like, they're obviously, they do get well-received by the people that go to see them, but like in terms of, you know, who they're influenced by and the lyrics you write for the band, did you want them to be a good band?
Yeah, I think that was an interesting one, because my mentors really, like, look, at the beginning they were kind of like, maybe not amazing, they were kind of like good, but like it was more about the characters, and she was like, well, no one's gonna be interested in a decent band. They either need to be like really, really crap, like in Flight of the Conchords, and that's the kind of part of the joke, or they need to be shit hot and something happens where, you know, it comes off the rails, and there's, you know, and no spoilers, but you know, there's curveballs in there and spanners in the works. And so that's, she said, that's the interesting thing. There needs to be a buzz around them in their small town. They need to be good and start playing in London, have interests and stuff. And then that's when the readers can be interested if it happens or not for them. And I think that's correct. But I didn't want them to be like Oasis or Blur, not, obviously they're great bands, but I didn't want it to be a real Brit poppy kind of thing. And the lyrics I wrote were, again, I was like, I wanted to write lyrics as if I was 17, 18. So I was like, oh, they need to be like good, but a little bit shit as well. So sort of sixth form poetry kind of lyrics. yeah. And I kind of mocked up one of their songs on Logic on my laptop, just so I could get a feel of what I thought they sounded like, which is somewhere sort of around, I don't know, Smashing Pumpkins and that kind of thing, rather than a Britpop-y kind of bands, slightly heavier, but yeah, I wanted them to be good, and otherwise it's just no interest for the reader.
That'd be interesting to hear that song, actually.
Oh, I need a lot of work. It was just just to get it straight in my head, and you know, just so I could write the lyrics, and you know, I really enjoyed making up their set lists for their fake songs, and, and you know, books interspersed with like reviews of their gigs and their EPs and stuff like that. And I enjoyed writing, being the critic for once, and writing those and stuff. So yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose like another obvious question would be like, you know, you mentioned Amy and other characters like that. Were they based on anyone, kind of thing? Or did you have like, I don't know, is it kind of relatable experience with people?
Yeah, there is. There's a lot of myself in the book, but to be honest, the stuff that's in there that's real is probably the most boring bits. It's like little lines or little things, tiny bits that happened and stuff like that. There's one bit where they're playing a gig in London and somebody picks up one of their flyers that they've had printed off the counter, the table bar, and basically takes their chewing gum out and puts it in the flyer and then throws it in the bin. And I was like, I vividly remember that happening, because I was like, oh, look, someone's taking an interest in our flyer. And then he just put his chewing gum in it and put it in the bin. And I was like, and he was literally just looking for something to put his chewing gum in. He wasn't interested in the band at all. And that's like a very small moment in the book. And there's lots of little small moments like that. But the actual main plot and main characters and stuff is all, it's not real. I couldn't have... There's a guy called Carl Ove Nordskard, a Norwegian guy who writes autofiction, and he uses his own name, and he uses all his like ex-girlfriend's names and all his family. And basically just, this book sold loads, but he just ended up pissing off everyone he knew, because it was like he hadn't changed anyone's names or done anything. And it's just like all, autofiction, as they call it. And no, I didn't want it to be that. But, you know, there's a lot of true experiences in there, but mainly it's all fictional.
Yeah, yeah. My dog's growling. I don't know why.
What's wrong?
So yeah. And what about the The name Sharpshooter, where did that come from?
That came from, and I think I meant to change it, but basically from Bret the Hitman Hart, the wrestler. That was his special move, or his finishing move that he did. And obviously in 97, it was kind of around the time that I thought if they were trying to find a name for a band, they would probably pluck something from telly or a film or wrestling or something like that. And I wasn't in love with it, but I just left it in there as like a placeholder. And then after a while, and that's the same with some of the character names, and but once you've been writing it for a few months or weeks, you then can't imagine them being called anything else, the band, the characters or whatever. You know, like my mentor suggested a name change to one of the girls in it, and I changed it. And then I had to change it back because in my mind, that wasn't what she was called. She was called Charlotte, not whatever. You know, and that was the same with the band. I tried some different names and I was like, no, Sharpshooter. It's like kind of, it sounds like what a band would be called back then. So, yeah, it was from wrestling.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. I thought, like you said, I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but there were some definitely emotional bits in there. And like you say, it's like it's quite good just reading about this kind of thing. Like, I don't think I've read a novel with this kind of thing in it before. So it's nice, kind of like it's nostalgic, kind of like reading someone's experience of it. Yeah,
it's good. Exactly. I think I've read one book, Dance Prone by David Coventry, about a band. It's more on like the US hardcore scene, sort of punk scene and stuff, which was an influence, which my mentor actually told me about. I'd already started writing it, but she said, oh, you should read this book. And that really rung true. But other than that, yeah, I don't know of many novels that really captured what I wanted to capture. So yeah, I didn't want it to be pure nostalgia. It is set in 97, and there are a lot of references to like little TV shows that are on, and Tamagotchis and like little bits and stuff like that. But ultimately, I want it, you know, the boy girl story in it could be happening now. The technology would be different, but it's universal enough, and there's still bands, you know, in that same period of their career as there was there in the book and stuff now. So I was very wary of it not just being a full nostalgia fest, even though most of the reviews do mention that it's a really nostalgic read and stuff. And and what you're saying about, you know, the emotional bits and stuff. I was at work last week, and this girl came in and was like, I've got a bone to pick with you. Your book made me cry last night. And I was like, oh, I'm really sorry. And but secretly I was like, yes, because, you know, you want to elicit a response out of your readers, be it, you know, smiling, laughing, crying, or just making them think about, you know, it touches on grief and depression a bit at times and stuff. And that kind of weight came to it a bit later, because I was like, yes, it's the first few chapters, yes, it's fun, but beyond that, what am I trying to say? And if I had any advice to people writing, you know, I'm not an expert, I've had one book out, but is to plan before you write too much. I'd get a chapter or two down so that you get a feel of the tone and whether you're going to write it from first person or third person and the basic characters and stuff. But I read something that said I wouldn't start the first, this was an experienced author, and he said, nowadays I wouldn't start the first page of my novel unless I knew what the last page was going to be. And
okay, that's interesting.
I kind of agree with that, because yeah, after I got a few chapters in, I literally, like, I need to sit down here and plan what's going to happen. And that was the worst bit, was when my mentor would come back with changes, which I agreed with. But once you start pulling any threads and moving bits around and changing, relationships or whatever within the book and stuff, that's when it just came an absolute headache. I'd have a double page spread in a notebook of what's happening and what needs moving, and it had to draw out the map of the town so that I was consistent in stuff. You know, if they go up the hill to the college, they can't go down the hill to the college next time. You know, stuff like that. And that was the period that it was a real like sort of love hate affair with this book over the period of like 2 years, when sometimes I was like, yeah, that's great, and sometimes I wanted to throw it out the window. Hopefully it's definitely all been worth it in the end. And then this period now where people are reading it and, you know, sending me bits that made them smile or reminded them of bits and stuff, and, you know, getting reviews. I've had some reviews from people in America and New Zealand and Singapore who are reading the Kindle version and stuff. And I don't know what they make of all the references to Bodger and Badger and very British stuff. But they seem to be enjoying it. So, yeah, it's great.
Yes. Yeah, I wrote down a couple of things, like there was a line that said, I think it was Will, said he felt one shade up from Sadness on the Dulux chart, which I thought was a good line. Yeah. And some of the song lyrics are pretty good as well, to be fair.
Yeah, they actually, one of the lyrics is very much based on an Absent Kid lyric. And when the publisher was running it through, like, the lyrics through to check out and plagiarise, they're like, oh, this one's from a, seems to flag a lyric from Absent Kid. And I was like, oh, that's fine, that's my old band. we can use that. The only others weren't that close to other stuff. And so, yeah. But yeah, generally, I enjoyed writing the lyrics and stuff for them and the songs and the set lists and stuff. And yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Did you like, when you're writing lyrics, were you like, I don't know how you write songs anyway, but did you have a guitar in your hand at the time or anything?
No, I didn't. I had to make sure they kind of scattered to a rhythm in my head. No, I didn't. I didn't, apart from one song I mocked up, Vital Signs, it was called. I didn't do the rest. But I could kind of hear them in my head of how they should sound and how I tried to get them across on the page. Yeah.
Hmm. Oh, cool. And yeah, I guess we're not really like, is this a full-time thing or has this been like a side project?
Oh, no, it's just been a side project. I've been working full-time doing marketing for a really nice company near here where I live, and everyone's been really supportive there and stuff. And it was just writing in the evenings. Sometimes I do some editing in my lunch break, but you really need to be like fully in the frame of mind for it. So it was just like, yeah, an evening. Sometimes I'd wake up early because I'd be thinking about the book and I'd start writing at like 6-7 a.m. before work. And sometimes just whenever it grabbed me, I'd have to, in the middle of the night, an idea would come into my head of something a character could say or whatever, and I'd have to get my phone out and make a note, or in the middle of the night, otherwise I'd forget it and stuff like that. It consumed me over that period of a couple of years, really.
And would you be tempted to write like a follow-up or like another book?
Yeah, some people have asked me, because the way it ends is slightly open-ended, and I could do. It really depends if there's a call for it. Nobody, you know, I don't want to write a sequel to a book that, you know, there's not enough call for. But I definitely will write something. I'll leave it a few months at least to promote this one as fully as I can and get as much out of this as I can and learn as much from this process as I can. But yeah, I'll probably write something, but whether it'll be music based or whether I'll try and write something more that's got more mass appeal, I don't know. You know, it's like something, you know, crime or thrillery type thing. They you know, they sell a lot more. My girlfriend was like, next time can you write a book that's going to make us some money?
Wait a minute, it might get an ITV drama or something.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, it'd be great. And I mean, there's 500 copies printed, so I, you know, my expectations are realistic and fairly small. Obviously, people can get it on Kindle or beyond that, but I think if those sell relatively quickly, there's the option of a reprint and stuff. But if someone can make a TV show of it, that'd be amazing. I'll do the music.
Yeah, fair. I wonder who could play Will. Be interesting.
Yeah, a couple of people asked me that, and then in my mind I'm like, oh, you know, Nicholas Holt or someone like that, but he's probably about 35 these days, so I don't really know who the 17 18 19 year old people are. Maybe the lad from Sex Education, Asa Butterfield or whatever, he can probably pass off being 18 year old still. But yeah, maybe interesting.
Yeah okay, Mal, that's it. It's like, where is the best place for people to buy it, really?
Amazon, Waterstones and WH Smith's online. If you search Fragments of Youth, got it here if anyone watching, orange cover. And then it's also available in some bookshops in Colchester, Red Lion Books and Best Days Vintage, which is actually a record shop, but they've kindly stocked some copies, really great place. And then Parade's End Books in Kingston, I've got it. But generally, Amazon, I'm afraid. I mean, if you want to avoid Amazon, there are other places, Waterstones, WH Smith's, or you just search Fragments of Youth and various other smaller bookshops and stuff online. I've got it as well, but I don't mind really, as long as you buy it and enjoy it. get it from wherever you're comfortable.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it, mate, definitely, so I would recommend it. And yeah, we'll play out the podcast to one of your songs then. Which one do you want to play out to?
Oh, quite a playground, please. Yeah.
Nice, good one, that one. Yeah. What about the video for that? Did you Was that something you did off your own back, or was that a Fierce Panda thing or anything?
That was a friend of the family actually ran a small video production place in Colchester, and we asked him, and I think they did it for free for us. Looking back, it does seem very low budget. At the time, we thought it was like great, but it got played on MTV2, which was great. In fact, that's another thing with bad luck we had as well. Like they MTV2 put the wrong title on the video.
Really?
They called it Shame on Us All, which was another one of our songs, but instead of Quiet Playground, which didn't help when it came to downloads and stuff.
That's annoying, yeah.
Fierce Panda also printed some promo CDs, and John Kennedy, we did a session for him, but he also went to play, I think it would have been Shame on Us All, and basically this weird jazz music started playing, and they've been like a muck up at the factory that did our promo CDs, and some of them, we don't know how many, but had like the completely wrong song that wasn't us on it, and stuff like that. Like you're sitting at home and you're just like fuming. You can't do anything about it other than we sent them a proper CD, like, and they played it like 2 days later. But by that point, you know, you sort of told your friends or fans that you're being played on the radio that night, and it's just, and Fierce Panda like were pissed off with wherever it was, this factory in Blackburn or somewhere that made the CDs. But at that point, I think we'd just been in the city in Manchester, and we'd been handing out all these promo CDs, and we didn't know how many of them like had our song, how many of them had like this completely like weird sort of chilled, like I don't know what it's like, it was something like More Sheba or someone like that, it wasn't them, but it sounded like that, which is fine, but it just wasn't us. It was just like, it was just stuff like that just drove me crazy. But I don't know. I think we had as much good luck as we had bad luck. So I don't want to dwell on it.
Yeah, fair play, mate.
But also, I promise I'm playing in another band these days with my brother is singing. We do some Absent Kids songs, and we do some new songs, and we just recorded last weekend. So that's called Lost Movies, which took us ages to come up with a name. So many names are taken these days. You come up with a decent name and then someone on Spotify's got it. So Lost Movies, we're on Instagram and Twitter and stuff. If we play mainly in Essex, but we do play in London sometimes. We played in Camden, Barfly last year and stuff. So yeah, if anyone digs Absent Kid, come and see Lost Movies and we'll play some of the songs. And this has been really fun to play again with friends. And it's just doing it now like as more of a hobby and just really enjoying it. And you know, we want to push it as far as we can, but not, you know, when someone's got kids, we all live all over the place. So we just play gigs like maybe like once a month and record. And it's been really great to get on stage again, like after a big gap of several years. So
I've listened to that. Yeah, I can imagine it's I'd like to do it, to be honest. I'd like to get in to like a hobby band, like you say, where it's not like do or die. It's just you're doing it for the fun of it.
Just really enjoying it. And we played a gig at the Colchester Arts Centre on New Year's Eve, which was really good, with a local band called The Mess, who are doing well. They're sort of in the punk scene and stuff. And we're just playing in, it's like we won't say no to gigs. I don't mind playing smaller like pub gigs and stuff. And just really enjoying it. And it was good to record last weekend. I hadn't been into the studio for a while, and we're still waiting on the mixes. We'll get them sometime next week, I guess. And so that will put stuff up on Spotify for that, Lost Movies. But it's just really fun to play again. And I think that's it. It's just like playing with friends. It's just like nothing beats getting into a room with your mates and playing at full volume and stuff. Like over lockdown, I play acoustic at home and stuff, and you get there and you can, you know, whack your amp up and play along with a drummer and stuff. And it's that very visceral feeling that you just can't replicate at home. And and just a social thing, like the weekend we're recording and you go for beers and food and stuff. And when you're not putting that pressure on yourself, where you've not got that knots in your stomach about everything that you're doing, it's just enjoyable again.
Nah, yeah. A bit jealous, to be fair. It sounds great.
Honestly, get it off the ground before you're... Before you're like 40, 45, it's a bit tragic. But you got a few more years in you, yeah.
Yeah, anyone in the Manchester area fancies it, let me know,
Oh, well, there you go. Manchester, you've got all the venues and all the scene compared to us in Colchester. So, you've got it. What instrument did you play?
Guitar. And I carried on writing songs and just sticking them on SoundCloud, but, you know, like when nobody hears them.
So, I remember on the last one you sent some to the Strokes producer, didn't you? And he was very complimentary about it.
Yeah, no, yeah. I was surprised when he was like, when he's like, I won't reply if I didn't like it, kind of thing. I was like, I'll take that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. The quiet.